Welcome to the Herd Quitter Podcast. I'm your host, Jared Lumen. On this show, we talk to farmers and ranchers who aren't afraid to think for themselves and do things a little bit differently. We hope these guests will challenge you to look at your farms and ranches in a new way and result in a more profitable and enjoyable business for you and your family.
Hello and welcome back to the Herd Quitter Podcast. I'm excited for today's conversation. It's Gage Iverson from Montana, another recommendation of Trevor Burian, and I was just kind of commenting to him how this is almost becoming a little series here of a few episodes in a row. We're ahead, two episodes in a row, kind of on people switching from cow-calf to stockers, and the folks listening to this will I think before this conversation here, my conversation with Dallas Mount, where we talk about not switching from cow-calf to stockers and how to make the cow-calf enterprise more profitable. And today's guest is Gage Iverson from Montana, who's finding a way to make cow-calf profitable in an upper northern environment with some tough winters. And so I appreciate this. This is going to be a cool kind of conversation to contrast the ones we've had over the last few weeks. And I really appreciate you, Gage, taking a little bit of time out of your day to join me. So welcome to the Herd Quitter Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Well, I guess before we dive too much into that or winters or anything like that, tell me a little bit about yourself, where you're at. What does your ranch look like, your enterprises and operations? Tell me a little bit about what you're doing.
All right. Yeah. Gage Iverson. Our ranch is the Dovetail Creek Ranch. I'm the fifth generation, and I've got my wife and three kids that were out here, work with my dad. He's mostly a lot of the office work. And then if there's bigger days that need two people working the hill, come out and join me. And then my grandpa just finally, I shouldn't say finally, but he just retired.
Yeah. Just retired. How old is he, if you don't mind me asking?
He's in his 80s. Wow. So
it's pretty incredible. That's dedication. Loved what he did, apparently.
Mm-hmm. And he was out here all but 4 years of his life that he went away to college, and then he came right back.
Wow. Huh. So. Yeah. Oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah. Cool. Okay. So sorry, I cut you off there and your grandpa a little bit. What all's your ranch enterprises and whatnot?
Yeah. So our enterprises are primarily a cow calf. We've got a ranch lease that we're looking to expand into stockers, whether that is for sure our own heifers, whether or not we hold over our steers as well. But then there would also be room for bringing in a bunch more heifers to do like a bred heifer program, or bring in steers as well.
Cool. Okay. So I guess going back in the history of the ranch, I'm not sure how much you know of it. You said you're fifth generation. Do you know much about the story of how that ranch came to be? I'm always personally intrigued by those stories of some of those ranch starts.
Yeah. So it's a homestead ranch. Would it be my two greats grandpa? Mm-hmm. He came over from Norway and got off the train in, I don't know if it was Winnet or Tagen. They're just kind of down the road from each other. Ended up marrying a gal that grew up, I think, in the next town over in Norway. Then they moved out here and homesteaded. And kind of the big story about him is that he didn't like horses. And when they were starting to have kids, that she went to Lewistown, which is 80 miles away, and it's only an hour and a half now, but he didn't like horses, so he walked to Lewistown to meet her at the hospital after she had a kid.
Wow. Just didn't like horses, and so he decided to walk.
Well, there's no known fact that he didn't like horses, but that's our suspicion, is that because who would walk the 80 miles to Lewistown?
Yeah, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
For any reason.
Yeah, no, I can't see a good one. Wild. Okay, so he started the ranch there then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and from the start back then, was that always cow-calf?
I don't know what initially it was. I'm sure, it was probably a mix of, the milk cow and some sheep and some farming and stuff like that. But
yeah.
I know, like, during World War II, that we were sheep and we ran wethers. Okay. So we didn't have to worry about lambing. That it was just all the value was in the wool. So they ran wethers.
So everything was sheep in the World War II era then?
I don't know if everything, but I know the major profit center was sheep. And then when Grandpa came home, that he switched it over to cattle was the main enterprise.
Yeah. Well, you hear about there a lot of those historic ranches were paid for, bought with sheep. And then once they had it paid for, they'd switch to cattle and stuff. So sounds like that was maybe part of the story, at least part of the history. Who knows what percentage of it, but at least part of the history of your place. Sheep made a lot of sense.
Dad had some sheep, but then he got rid of them. And I was around the sheep just enough to know that you might have to pay me to start running sheep.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it turns out from what most people say is they do pay pretty well. So they might. No. Cool. So your grandpa switched back to cattle. And I'm curious at the start, I guess, talk about the history of the cattle enterprise that you had there. I mean, what kind of model was it? Was it kind of the normal turn them out to graze, pull them back in the fall, feed all winter, make your own hay? That kind of a business model?
I don't know about the wintering, but I know that it'd be our summer allotments on the BLM ground that we have, that was in the commons. So everyone just turned their cattle out.
Sure.
Their own kind of designated area where the cattle were supposed to be, but there were no fence lines. So, you know, you might get a phone call from someone, you know, 30 miles away saying, "Hey, I got your cattle in the corral."
I've always wondered, and do you still farm and kind of ranch in common ground, or is everything private now?
I think that was all fenced in. I think when Grandpa was young, he might have been younger than me when they put in all that fence that divided it into three pastures, you know, and each one I think is like 8,000 or 9,000 acres.
Wow.
At the time. Mm-hmm. They've been since subdivided again, but
yeah,
that was the initial, you know, fencing into the cattle.
Well, how did that work? Because I'm in Minnesota and that's not a very common thing where people, so this was the commons. This wasn't just like this wasn't like pre-fence era where it was, everything was on kind of open rangeland. Is this kind of like a government lease that there are people, multiple people who all had a lease on the same ground kind of a thing? Or was it just, there was no fence. And so everybody's land was separated, but cattle kind of all mingled together.
It's just that country is so rough that, you know, fencing it back then, it just wasn't an option.
Okay.
So they would, you know, you have your ground that you were allotted for a grazing lease. But yeah, because there was no fences, there was no way other than, you know, going out and riding on them to hold them in those areas.
Okay. Oh, fascinating. Things we don't have to deal with or had never really dealt with here in Minnesota, but now it's all separated off. So you have your chunk and the neighbors have theirs and stuff. And since then, I guess, is it still kind of, is land in your area mostly privately owned, or is there a lot of government lease?
I wouldn't know like the percentages, but I know like you get the southern half of Petroleum County, which is where I live, that is mostly private, but you get into the northern third, the public ground, I would say, is probably in the majority. And that's mostly because it was, you know, those initial homesteaders came out there and couldn't make it. And then the federal government came in and took possession of that ground. Mm-hmm. And then they just have never turned it back over to local landowners.
Okay. So I talked with Trevor Burian is who gave me your contact, and he kind of said you've made some pretty impressive changes with your cow-calf wintering and to reduce your cost significantly. I'm curious before we get into that specifically, what did your operation look like for winter feeding, summer grazing and cost structures prior to maybe realizing that something had to change? And then after that, we'll talk about what those changes were. But what did the operation look like, I guess, as far as management prior to that?
The old historic would have been, you know, this is back 20 plus years. You know, the cattle have come home from the summer allotments and they would have essentially gone straight on to feed until, you know, the turnout in May again. So that could easily, you know, be anywhere from 4 to 6 months, depending on how the year went, because all the land around the house was farm ground. So there was no, you know, winter pastures close to the house to graze on. And then, yeah, I think it was about 20 years ago that we entered into a lease agreement with a neighbor that is absent. He's an absentee owner that owns the ground for hunting, because we're in big elk hunting country.
Okay.
So we would do all the farming on his place to pay for our grazing. And then all the farming was to feed the elk.
Okay. Sure.
That plant, you know, wheats and, or oats and barley, peas.
I see. Okay.
Some alfalfa and stuff.
Okay. So it was actually plant. It was like a feed plot. It was specific. He was planting that not just to, it just didn't just happen to get grazed by elk. It was intended to do that for his hunting. It, I see. Okay. And that was your, what that was essentially your rent was to be exchanged for your labor and management of the farmland for the lease of the grazing land.
Mm-hmm. And Dad and I have run the numbers, and it's pretty even.
Okay.
Between those two.
Good.
And then that would get us in, you know, grazing through, you know, into January, January, February in there somewhere. And then we would have to start feeding.
So with that, when you picked up that new lease, what was the thought process to, instead of just adding more cows and grazing that the same as you grazed your own grass all summer long, why did you choose instead to stockpile that for winter grazing?
Initial reason behind that, I don't know. I think we've kind of always recognized that there is a significant cost to hay, and we actually have moderately mild winters compared to, you know, the surrounding 100 miles around us. So I think it was just, it was convenient. We had more grass. We can continue to graze. And then it was also, we can't graze this in, you know, the spring, because then it'll, the grass will start growing. And we, you know, he's wanting that grass also for his elk as well.
I see.
So it was just kind of a winter grazing. It was just perfectly situated for that.
Okay. That makes sense. It seems like, I mean, most people, I mean, that's kind of an unusual thought process what you had there, because most people would just see more grass as more cows. I mean, that's the kind of common sense. Why change my program? I just do more of the same because I have access to more grass. But you were sort of forced into doing something different, and maybe helped you realize that it even could be done.
Well, actually, now that I had a moment to think about that, the big reason would be because of our summer allotments, we're only allowed, it's not on a, you know, AUM equivalent grazing lease. So it doesn't matter if you're running 1900 pound cows or if you're running 1000 pound cows, it's on a per head basis. And actually just in the last year or two, they've switched it to, you know, there is no even a yearling factor.
Hmm.
So one cow, you know, it doesn't matter if it's a yearling, 500 pound yearling or a 1900 pound cow, they view that as one animal.
Wow.
So that would be why we didn't increase our herd numbers.
Well, that alone is a whole other separate rabbit trail we could go on. You would think over time people would change for the better, but they're changing it even worse, where even a 600-pound calf is considered the same as a 1,600-pound cow. That's just illogical and doesn't make much sense. But like I say, that's a whole other rabbit trail we can go down. Mm-hmm. So anyway, you picked up this lease, and intentional or not intentional, you ended up using that for winter grazing and maybe learning for the first time that you can graze later into winter, and that it was significantly cheaper than making hay. Did that, how did those first years go? Or what was there concern that you would have all this grass stockpiled that would just get buried in snow? I mean, like you said, most people are not feeding, or most people are feeding right after they come off the leases. Was there some concerns with that?
You know, as long as there's not the snow that we can graze, you know, this is, you know, you're asking questions about mindsets from when I was, you know, in kindergarten. So I can't answer that.
That's fair. Fair. Okay. So yeah, that was anyway, either way, that was 20 years ago. That was the start. Where has it progressed till now then, I guess? What are you're grazing significantly longer than that, and what changes have been made to do that?
So it was the winter of 17 and 18.
Mm-hmm.
I was off working at this time that I had moved away, but I think the snow, you know, got 2 feet of snow in October and had all that snow until I think there was, we still had snow banks in June or July the next year. Wow. That we just had so much snow that it just never, it came early and it never left.
Yeah.
And it was that going into that following winter that we were sitting around sometime at Christmas and Dad looked at me and said, I'm ready for you to come home. And I was moved home by New Year's.
You were ready then.
Yeah, I was. Well, I found a gal that was crazy enough to want to move out into the middle of nowhere. So I was living in Bozeman, which is, you know, we refer to it as Bo's Angeles, if that gives you any indication of what it's actually like over there. Oh, yeah. So I was ready to leave and come home anyway.
That's funny. I like that. I joke that Minnesota is the California of the Midwest. So I guess I can kind of understand maybe what you're referring to.
Mm-hmm. So that was, yeah, New Year's of 19. Mm. And that was also a fairly snowy winter. So we fed most of that winter. And then coming around into the next fall, by that point, I had attended the Ranching for Profit school and had done a little strip grazing with our replacement heifers. So I had a little experience with that.
Mm.
And going into that winter, there just wasn't any hay. The prices weren't too bad, but, you know, to get hay in, we'd be looking at Eastern Dakotas or, you know, up, almost up to Idaho to bring in hay, and it would be the trucking that would get us. So I just kind of volunteered, hey, I'll strip graze this, you know, our neighbor's place just to do it and see how it works. And I ended up stretching that pasture by, we figured it was good for 50 days of grazing, and I got us all the way up to 75 days. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just kind of progressed from there. We ended up going into a severe drought the next year, and we had to completely destock this ranch. And that is where we picked up a lease on another ranch and hauled the cattle all off over there and ended up winter grazing again, not because we wanted to. It was then, it was the price of hay was so outlandish. I mean, I was hearing prices of $300, $400 a ton.
Mm-hmm.
And that just doesn't pencil.
So where was the grass that you were grazing at that point? If you said, you know, it was a drought at the home place and you moved all these cattle to another place, where was the winter grazing coming from?
It was just south of my hometown, Winnett, and which was 30 miles. And that area was in a drought. But where we turned the cattle in on, it was farm ground that had been planted back to grass. And mm-hmm. the landowner just hit it perfectly with the planting and the weather. Okay. So she had a wonderful stockpile of grass just waiting there needing cattle.
Sure.
That we got lucky on.
Wow. Okay. So, I mean, grazing through the winter, you kind of did it accidentally then, but you've grazed the last couple of years now through the entire winter, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's the, I mean, is this, were these 2 years, would you say they were flukes, I guess, as far as weather-wise, or is this consistent that your weather allows you to do that, or will allow you to do that?
I remember more brown Christmases than I do white Christmases, if that says anything. Last winter, we had probably all winter, probably anywhere from 8 to 12 inches of snow on the ground.
Okay.
And we grazed all through that. I fed 2 days last winter, and that was only because it was 30 below.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't stand to let them just hide behind a hill and try and stay warm.
As far as winter feed, then, if this is the goal going forward, how do you, I guess something I've always wondered is how do you justify or setting grass aside, not grazing it during the grazing season for and setting aside the stockpile for winter feed with the hopes that the weather is open, I guess. Is it just kind of a educated gamble that the winter will be open? And if it's not open and it's buried in snow, Is there a way to utilize that in the future, or is it kind of a waste of a crop, a waste of a grass crop, and however much you have invested into that land rent?
So I guess how I justify the cost of all that of the labor is I figure when I go out, because I've started, you know, strip grazing all summer now too.
Okay.
And I figure that that, you know, strip grazing, that you're moving across the ground land slower, so you're actually extending your grazing season by extending that out. And I did a TikTok on it and
check was that out.
Just describing how, you know, moving cattle every other day, and I figure my value to show up and do that is $250, and that includes, you know, my vehicle and my labor.
Sure.
And I think that's a good value for that. And I compared to that, you know, year round moving cattle like that, and then compared that to the cost of hay, and it was roughly, for us, it was worth about 26 days of feeding hay is what my, you know, year round labor is. So I was just, you know, goofed off, and, you know, our kind of the standard stocking rate, the rule of thumb stocking rate that everyone around here uses, that I just went and I tightened that up by 10% and then compared that number. And that was the, it was 30 days of grazing that just that 10% increase in the stocking rate, you know, created that 30 days of grazing.
So you only needed to increase your stocking capacity by 10% to pay for your labor for an entire year at $250 a day.
Mm-hmm. And that was every other day of labor that,
yeah,
the cattle are far enough away from where I live that it moving daily is not, the labor logistics start getting in the way.
Yeah. Well, that seems pretty reasonable to expect a 10% increase. I mean, I talk to people all the time on this podcast who are seeing 100%, 200 or 300% increases in productivity when they start doing some strip grazing and management.
And I'm grazing light still, that I could be a lot higher density, but these improved pastures, you know, that were farm ground, that there's a lot of bare ground there still. So I'm trying to go light, you know, hope for more of a trample effect rather than consumption to get that ground covered. Okay. Because the first year that we were out there, I would bet it was 80% bare ground, and I might be down to 50% now.
So easily justifying your labor, I guess. And maybe that's part of where you have all this extra grass to be able to increase your, or to be able to graze later in the winter. But I guess I was just wondering, like, essentially when you, it was kind of like how I had asked earlier about, you have picked up this new pasture, why not add more cows? Whether it's through grazing management or picking up a new lease, you have more grass. And the easy option for what most people would do is, I have more grass, I should get more cows. But for some reason you've chosen instead, I have this extra grass, I'm going to let it stockpile, and I'm going to choose instead to graze that over the winter. And I guess I'm curious, if you get a big snowfall and that grass gets buried, maybe you don't consider it a loss, because prior to your management changes, you never actually had the extra grass in the first place. So it's not really a loss. It's just you're still maintaining where you would have been prior to getting the extra grass. But I didn't know if that's a concern of, we have all this extra grass, and if it gets buried, we've lost a lot of potential revenue, I guess, in grass. Or you're maybe just pretty confident now after a couple of years that you're going to be able to graze through more years than not, and overall that saves enough money to justify the risk.
And we have a emergency stack of hay that,
sure,
you know, if it were to tonight dump, you know, 2 feet of snow or something like that and not leave, that we would make it to make it into the spring, that we have enough hay just sitting on standby.
Okay.
But if I can graze it, I would much rather do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's actually what we were just talking, I was just talking about with Dallas Mount before here, is like, farmers that want to do this, the concern is the year that it gets buried, and now you have to buy hay in the worst time of the year when everybody else needs it because everybody's short and you have to pay a high cost. And so for folks, the safety net might be having this year supply or winter supply of hay so that you can weather the tough years, I guess. But overall, the savings of not buying hay year after year after year justifies, yeah, the expense maybe in having that hay sitting there, the equity or whatever else that goes into it.
I think last year, can't remember the exact numbers, that if we didn't winter graze, it would have been roughly $90,000 to feed that winter. And because of my labor, it cost, you know, about $40,000. So we ended up saving, you know, what is it, $50,000 in not having to feed hay.
And you would have still had labor had you had to feed hay, if not potentially even more, probably, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or was the $90,000 including your labor to feed the hay? Or was that just the cost of the hay?
No, that was just the cost of getting the hay into a hay yard.
Wow. Yeah. But
that didn't include, would it be $150 an hour in a tractor to put hay out?
So likely you probably saved the full $90,000 if your labor was a wash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, potentially, yeah.
Huh. So what is all the labor that goes into this? And I mean, I don't know your landscape. Is it rocky ground? How are you strip grazing and subdividing these paddocks? And I know you mentioned 20 years ago there were 8,000-9,000 acre paddocks. What do you have for what is it now, and how are you managing that, especially in the winter?
So the summer allotments that were those large pastures, that those are only summer grazing. So primarily it around the house now, all that farm ground has been planted back to grass, but we're currently over on that, on the neighbor's place, grazing that. And it has a large reservoir kind of very centrally located with large coulees radiating away from that, kind of in a very nice wagon wheel shape. And I will just strip graze away from the water point, you know, up these coulee bottoms and get to the back of the, you know, the far end, and then bring them back to the reservoir, move them over a coulee bottom, and then graze up the next one.
Will you every year, kind of the same years, do you alternate which paddocks and which areas are summer grazing versus winter grazing? And has that impacted, I guess you're maybe still pretty early into it, but giving years this full year of rest to stockpile, have you seen any differences in following your grass production and growth?
Probably the dead of winter will always be this neighbor's property, just because that it's a good place. There's a lot of cover there. Like around the homestead, it opens up a lot and there's not quite as much cover. Our biggest threat really in the winter is wind chill. So to be able to have, you know, some hillsides and some trees and stuff that the cattle can get into is,
sure,
you know, there's a value to that as well.
That makes sense. Well, I forget. I think it was Cooper Hibbard maybe that talked about some of the biggest impacts he saw in grazing and grass and stuff were years after winter grazing. I need to listen back to that podcast. It's come up in a few conversations here recently, but I thought he talked about that being some of the biggest impact of ground was the ground he was able to winter strip graze on it. And, but it sounds like part of your context is that you have to have them off and that off of that farm during the spring and summer due to the whole hunting and everything and stuff too. So it just kind of works out in that context that it's going to be a winter grazing paddock.
Mm-hmm.
I guess with what are things that you consider and that people have to consider if they want to try winter grazing through the winter? And I mean, I think it sounds great. A lot of people, it sounds pretty awesome. Yeah, save $90,000 in winter feed, but it's not going to be just as easy as just keep them grazing all summer. I mean, you had to plan to have grass stockpiled. You had to obviously figure out how to do it. What are the things you had to consider to get through the winter?
Speaking of things to consider, if you are wanting to run a direct-to-consumer marketing business, then something you have to consider is who you're going to use for your website and e-commerce platform. The one that we have chosen to use with our company is Barn to Door. Barn to Door is an all-in-one solution built for farmers to help manage all of your direct sales, both online and in person. We've been using them now for 4 or more years, actually. And with Barn to Door, we've been able to build consistent recurring cash flow with subscriptions to our farm products. But most importantly, Barn to Door has helped us to save time.
They've done that by helping us simplify order management. And if you're looking to get time back with your family while operating a successful farm business, I'd encourage you to check out Barn to Door. You can go to www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter, where you can learn a little bit more about what we've done. And if you choose to sign up, you'll get access to a free academy session that is a $99 value. Again, the website is www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter.
The labor side, you know, that starts as soon as the, you know, your growing season starts. That you have to be planning on that. As far as like when you're in the depths of the winter grazing, you need you're going to need a good protein source. We use lick tubs just because they're convenient for us, and you can just throw them out. The cattle use them, and then you can, you know, move them to another spot, you know, when they finish a spoke. That if they're not too froze down, that you can move them over to the next one. Something that I've enjoyed is I like to have someone, you know, occasionally come and look at the cattle, because I'm the one, you know, seeing them all the time. And sometimes you won't notice that, you know, if body condition is starting to slip.
Sure.
That if you're, you know, kind of becomes a case of, you know, the boiling a frog.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. So with the protein specifically, this is the difference between supplement and substitution kind of feeding and stuff. Now you're supplementing the forage just for the additional protein, not substituting entirely with something different. What's your cost per day in the protein supplement alone?
Oh, I did that math at one point here. I got a lot of cat outside here. It's going to drive me crazy. That I don't know off the top of my head, but it is minimal compared to that cost of the hay. I do know that
yeah, sure.
You know, winter sense. Grazing, you know, to buy a, or, you know, to get in a, you know, a semi trailer full of protein tubs. Yeah, it would hurt initially, but it would be still be significantly cheaper than all that hay that you would be feeding.
Yeah. And were you making your own hay prior, or were you buying it?
Yeah, still making some hay. That's something that I would like to go, but because we are in elk country, there is a value to rolling it up and getting it put away, because if we don't, sometimes the elk will take it all if we don't get it picked up ourselves. So there is some value to doing some hay, but it wouldn't hurt my feelings if our haying equipment went down the road and we're just not tempted to do that.
Well, that was going to be a question of mine too, is the elk, because I've heard from many different people how elk can just devastate winter stockpile. Like anything, I mean, you can have stockpile to could feed your cattle all winter and have nothing after a herd of elk move through. So is that something you actually have to plan against, or how are you keeping your stockpile from being consumed by elk?
Well, like on this lease, it's just, you know, it's the reality of the situation that the elk, they get the first take and then I get to graze what's left. So that's a lot of just observation on my grazing part that, you know, to manage the cattle. On the rest of the place, it's so open that the elk really don't like it so much, because we have essentially two tees that are only offset by in the roads. I'm talking two tees in the road that kind of right in the center of it. And so there's a lot of hunters driving through during hunting season that actually hold the elk. So yeah, we get that hunter pressure that keeps those elk off of the open area. So it keeps them back up in the timber. So it would preserve some of that stockpile that we have around the house.
Oh, that's convenient. I guess it's an advantage of this person that you lease the grass from. I imagine the winter stockpile grass, I imagine you're not paying a full lease value for the grass if he's letting his elk consume part or majority of it, but it's not his primary concern. That's not his goal, is to maximize forage production. His goal is to maximize elk production, and then you get what's left over, and hopefully, I guess you probably just pay for what's left over or get it at a significantly reduced value, which works fine for you because you don't need it all, I guess.
It's a non-cash lease that the cost of the farming, you know, it's within a couple $1,000s of the grazing value.
The grazing value that you get, or the grazing value that would be there without the elk?
No, the grazing value that we get.
Okay. Well, that's
And then
perfect.
it actually works out tremendously in our favor because of that. What would have been, you know, the 50 days of feeding hay if we didn't have it, that's actually where the value for us is the hay that we don't have to feed because we have this lease.
Explain that again. Sorry, I might not have followed that.
So I think, what is it? When we did the numbers on it, that we have about $15,000 into the farming side of things.
Sure.
And then coming out on the other side for the grazing, it is roughly that same number.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's where the non-key lease or the non-cash lease comes into play, is because those values are roughly the same.
Okay.
Where we end up making a lot of money, or not making money, but the value to us is if we didn't have this lease, we would be feeding hay.
It's the opportunity expense. So, yeah, the alternative.
Yeah, opportunity, yes.
Sure, okay. No, that makes sense. Your cost is significantly lower. So do you guys farm as well? You've mentioned like this farming of this ground for this grass lease. You have a separate enterprise of farming that you have the overhead already and you're able to do that? Or do you have that stuff just for this specific enterprise?
We used to farm, so we have all the equipment.
Okay.
All of our farm ground has been planted back to grass or is currently in the process of being planted back to grass.
Mm-hmm.
So all the only farming that we do, and I guess I should not say we, that Dad does, I've made it very clear that I have absolutely no interest in farming.
Sure. Yeah.
That it's just on him. And it's, I don't know if it's quite 1,000 acres of farming in total that we do for him.
Okay. Sure. No, that makes sense. So do you foresee at some point then hiring that out, or does the 1,000 acres justify the overhead and equipment there to operate that?
Not the equipment that we have, even though it's depreciated out. If we had, you know, a smaller tractor, smaller drill, you know, maybe it would be justified, but, you know, upgraded our equipment to, you know, it's a John Deere air seeder. I don't know exactly what it is, but it's a little larger than what is needed. And then he also has a fairly large sprayer that, the acres is not quite enough.
Sure. Well, interesting. Either way, that's a pretty cool thing. I mean, you mentioned the, even if the equipment value is higher, it still works out pretty good on a trade for you for that feed. But I guess back to this, the ability to winter graze, what is your cow type that can get through the winter doing that? And then calving season, did you have to make any changes, or what's your calving season that aligns with you being able to graze through the winter?
Before, our calving season was, I think, you know, the heifers were in March and then the cows were in April. And right before I moved home, Dad moved that date back. So now the heifers are calving in April and the cows are in May.
Sure.
We have probably rubbing up on the smallest cows in the area.
Okay.
Or actually, I shouldn't say rubbing up on. I could probably just about guarantee you that we have the smallest cows.
Okay.
I'd say, you know, our largest cow might be, you know, 13 to 1400 pounds, but she's also very short. So
sure. Fleshy, thick, deep bodied cow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of more of that. Like Johann Zietzmann talks about the 8 pounds of sugar in a 5 pound sack. That
sure. Yeah.
Our big cows would be along those lines.
And were they always that type, or did you feel the need to do that when you went to grazing dormant forages? Because, you know, I imagine, I don't know, but your summer grass probably can sustain a bigger cow, I would think. And if you were on leases where you're paying by the head, not by the pound, or by the animal unit, you might slightly be incentivized to have a bigger cow. But now this move towards winter grazing is when you kind of have to have a cow that matches that environment.
Yeah, I don't know what the initial reasoning to start reducing our cow size was, because I would have been a little kid at that time.
Sure.
It started a long time ago that we started reducing our the cow size. I know, like when Dad was a kid, that was bragging rights was, you know, weaning weight.
Yeah.
That everyone was in a competition to see who had the biggest weaning weights. Mm-hmm. And whatever happened, I don't know if they, you know, even back then that they realized if they reduced the cow size a little bit, that, you know, the winter feeding expenses would have offset that, you know, that reducing weaning weight. I don't know exactly.
Yeah. Well, either way, it's the type of animal that aligns with what you do now. Cause whether, yeah, I don't know if folks had a 16, 17, 1800 pound cow, even with April or May calving in a protein tub, I don't know that they could handle what you're probably putting them through at this point.
Yeah, I would be surprised. Although I did buy some cows from our the ranch that we just leased, that she was culling a bunch of cattle, and she just, since I had just moved into the back home, that she asked if I wanted them. So I went through them and just took the youngest half of them, because I think they were all the way up to 15 years old. I think the youngest might have been 7. I mean, sure, they were her old cows, and I just took the young ones. And yeah, some of them are probably in the 14, 1500 pound range. And I have since culled down on them and got the smallest ones left. And I'd say that they're still, you know, maybe 1400 pounds. Mm-hmm. And they're doing all right, but they're not wintering as well as the, you know, our current 1200 pound cows.
Yeah. I'm curious. Do you, I don't know if you wean or just from eyeball or weigh, I mean, weaning, or if you can just eyeball. There's the study in North Dakota, I think, that talked about weaning weights, and the weaning weights on smaller cows were actually higher than some of the bigger cows in that specific environment in this study that this North Dakota state, I think it was, that did it. And, you know, it just kind of goes to show that it's not so much the genetic potential of an animal. Yeah, I mean, the 1500 cow probably has the genetic potential to have a heavier weaning weight than the 1200 pound animal. But if she's not adapted to that environment and has the ability to, if the environment can't sustain that genetic potential, then it doesn't matter. I'm curious, have you seen, even now with this side-by-side experiment in a tough kind of where you kind of real world harsh context, you push these cows pretty hard, have you seen anything weaning weight differences, or do your 1200 pound cows compete pretty well with those 1500, 1400 pounders? And in terms of weaning weight specifically,
those big cows, they do wean a larger calf.
Okay.
But what I had heard was that it was a lower percentage,
yeah,
of, you know, the calf weight to the mother weight,
yeah,
the dam weight. Yeah. So it wasn't necessarily that those smaller cows were weaning larger calves. It was the smaller cows were weaning a larger percentage of their body weight,
yeah,
than big cows, was, yeah, my understanding.
Yeah. And that's definitely like true. Most, like, typically the smaller animal will always wean a higher percentage of their body weight. But I always just thought there's this one example of this North Dakota study that actually found in the particular example, and it was a one year example. I think they had several different weights of cows in different groups, and the smaller animals actually weaned heavier calves, which, again, I'm not expecting to be a consistent trend. It was only because I think in that year there was a drought and the forage was tough, and the cows that were bigger, they had higher maintenance energy requirements. So they were able to, they can't produce milk until they meet their maintenance energy, and they didn't produce enough. The environment couldn't sustain the requirements that cow needed to produce the milk to get those calves to the weight of their genetic potential. And so the smaller cows that had that lower maintenance energy actually did better. And that's not going to be every situation every year. Either way, consistently, you could expect the smaller cow to have a higher percentage of their body weight. But I was just curious if you had seen anything. And sounds like they did still. You're able to see a slightly heavier weaning weight on those bigger cows, which is common. But
although last year that we had sold some, we retained most of the steers, but we just took a single pot load of kind of the middle,
yeah,
of the steers, and we did have one steer that I think outweighed the rest of them by, well, probably at least 100 pounds. over the average.
Okay.
And he was out of one of our, you know, 8 pounds of sugar in a 5 pound sack.
Sure.
He was out of one of those cows.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Yeah. And ultimately, yeah, I think you're probably better off with, well, it's all your context. Like you're saying, in the summer grazing, when you're paying on a per cow basis and you have a limited amount of cows, then, you know, maybe it does pay to have a bigger cow. I'm not sure. But again, with your winter feed cost, by having the right type of cow, you're able to reduce your costs so much more, and do better with that. But interesting conversation nonetheless. Okay. So your cow type, for the most part, is the more moderate frame, easy fleshing type. You've moved your calving season back to April and May. And do you make any changes? I mean, are they grazing dormant forage pretty much up until the day they calve?
No, we'll have, well, the heifers will be on predominantly dormant forage that you'll start seeing, you know, some tillers of the, you know, the coming year's growing season, they'll start coming up. So they will have a little, but it's nothing that you can count on, you know, maybe just enough to pull their head down and graze a little more aggressively.
Sure.
But definitely by the time our cows are calving, that they are, you know, that they're grazing green grass that, you know, the day they calve.
Is there anything else, I guess, that I haven't talked about specifically on this, like, winter grazing and how you've managed to make your cow calf operation profitable in an environment that not a lot of people show a profit on?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. It's probably one of those things that I'll think of something.
That's how it usually goes. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all right.
I'd say the big thing is to have kind of someone there to double check you just to make sure that you're not headed toward a wreck.
Oh, no, it's pretty cool because, like I said, the last couple people I've talked to, Trevor and I've talked to Ryan, and a lot of folks are switching from cow-calf to stockers, specifically in environments like yours that are heavy snowfall, cold temps, tough winters with high feed costs. And I was super intrigued to talk to you when Trevor mentioned that you've now managed to graze two winters throughout the entire winter without winter feed, because that's really what it takes. It seems like at least significantly reduced feed, if not eliminated feed. That's what it's going to take to help make these cow-calf enterprises more profitable. And it's pretty cool what you've done. I'll be excited to hear how it continues to go. And if you get more data that shows year after year, this is consistent, this is something you can do, then there's no reason other people can't do it too.
Mm-hmm. I've joked about how, you know, on TikTok, I've talked about, you know, the winter grazing and stuff like that. And it's usually, it's North Dakota or Wyoming people that really get wound up about that. And
yeah,
so I've started joking that, you know, they, pardon my French, but they, you know, they get, start doing a dick measuring contest about who has the harder winter.
Yeah.
So I've started saying in some of my videos, I'll mention, you know, oh, you know, there's always a longer and girthier winter out there, but this, you know, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah. We us cow guys and farmers in general, it's true. We probably do like to, we've got it pretty tough. We're the hardworking, you know, hardest working folks out there. I haven't had a vacation in 14 years, all this stuff. It's funny how we find so much pride in how tough we've got it. Where, yeah, it's an odd measurement to choose, or an odd metric to choose to brag about, but it's not uncommon.
No.
Cool. Okay. Well, then I guess I'll ask, you said you picked up a new lease here, and you're going to try stockers now. So you're not getting completely out of cows. Maybe in a few years you'll make the change anyway. But what was the motivation to try doing something different as opposed to continuing to expand the cow herd on this new lease?
It was actually my coming home, and Grandpa hadn't retired yet, that we needed to find a way to, you know, make more money, you know, to sustain three families instead of the two.
Sure.
Was the original deal behind that. But then we had a drought, so we had to completely destock the homestead and send the cattle over there. So it kind of made it a moot point. So yeah, we're just, yeah, that lease that we picked up, that we're going to most likely it'll be some form of stockers. We're not committing to that, only that one deal, that if,
yeah,
if the better buy is, you know, bringing in custom pairs or even, you know, buying like a bunch of short-term cows or something like that, that we'll go that route as well.
Okay.
So, but the homestead will most likely stay pairs because of the summer allotments, how that, you know, a cow is a cow.
Yep.
And the margin for us is better on running pairs out there than it would be if we were doing yearlings.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, awesome. So a couple questions I like to ask folks. One is, what resources would you recommend or have been important to you in kind of your learning experience coming back to the ranch? That can be books, podcasts, conferences, anything that's been valuable to you that you'd recommend people check out.
Yeah, so for sure, Herd Quitter.
Nice.
Working Cows and Ranching Reboot as well. They're my big three that I listen to. Mm-hmm. I would say Johann Zietzman's Man Cattle Velt. That's another good one.
That's a big book. I've been
working on. It's not too terrible.
Okay.
It's definitely, you have to be in the right mindset when you sit down and read it, though.
Sure.
It's not a light read.
Yeah.
I've been working on Andre Voisin's, Grass Productivity, that I've just about got that one finished up. And that would be for someone who's been grazing regeneratively for a while. But okay. I don't think there's a lot of value to a new person to pick up that book.
Okay. Yeah. All those are some good ones. Man Cattle Veld, I thought the book looked intimidating, so I hadn't read it yet. So I don't usually get into some of those big books because I know it's going to take me a couple of years probably to finish it, unless it's in audio format. I'll have to see if that's available, but awesome. Then lastly, where can people find you? You mentioned TikTok a couple times. I've already followed you on TikTok while we were talking here, because it's pretty cool. I think that that whole ag and TikTok and Twitter, and they've kind of got this niche in agriculture, and those are my favorite people to follow and stuff is some of these ag farmers, ranchers and stuff on Twitter and TikTok. So for people who think it's just a complete waste of time, there's a lot of learning potential on there. But yeah, where can people find you?
Yeah. So yeah, Dovetail Grazer on TikTok. And then I've started cross posting some of that stuff to YouTube under the same name, is where people can find me.
Cool.
Awesome. COVID chased me off of Facebook.
Okay.
So I got off of there.
Sure. That makes sense. Awesome. All right. Well, thanks so much for coming on, Gage. I appreciate what you're doing, trying some things new out there. And I appreciate you being willing to come on here and share with other folks. And you mentioned you'll think of something in a couple hours. If there's more you think on, or if you try this a couple more years and stuff, we ought to have another conversation to see how it keeps going as you progress. Cause I think if we can figure out the trick to grazing through winters in the upper United States, the northern United States, that is going to be a game changer. That's definitely our biggest challenge, I think, as far as cow calf guys out here. And you know, like everybody says, you can't do it here, but, and I'm sure you've got neighbors down the road saying you can't do it here. Well, here's Gage doing it right there. So I appreciate you coming on and sharing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'm happy you reached out to have me on.
The Herd Quitter Podcast is brought to you by Faro Cattle Company, whose mission is to help ranchers put more fun and profit into their business. You can get more information on Faro Cattle Company at farocattle.com. And if you enjoy what you've heard on this podcast, be sure to subscribe and check us out on Facebook and Instagram at Herd Quitter Podcast or at herdquitterpodcast.com.